Hello, 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 and welcome back to another edition of the Dog and the Duck Show. One team came out of the desert with a victory. Another team came out of the desert with a loss. But most people are thinking about what just went down with the Seattle Mariners blowing an epic game one against the Houston Astros in the second round of the playoffs in Major League Baseball. Mark, we're going to get into it all tonight. How are you doing, my friend?
Such a mixture of emotions, Warren. It's been an emotional roller coaster. I've had a couple highs and now a major low. You've had the high and the low simultaneously and now another low. But a lot to unpack from a very full last couple days.
Well, let's get into it. So, you know, as you mentioned, for a lot of Seattleites, there was, you know, a lot of mixed emotions on Saturday as, number one, our attention was divided between the Husky game against Arizona State on the road, which was taking place at the same time as the Seattle Mariners playoff game against the Toronto Blue Jays. So let's talk a little bit first about the devastating loss, if you can call it that. We shouldn't be surprised, Mark, because we talked about this. The Huskies have not won a game in the desert since 2001. It doesn't seem to matter if one team is 4-1 and the other is 1-4. When the Dogs get in the desert, bad things seem to happen. And true to form, it happened again this Saturday. The Huskies came out once again, started strong. That has been a common theme for this team in every single game this year. They have scored on their opening drive. And they did it again. They were up 7-0. They looked like they had a good control of the offense. But the offense was not the problem this past Saturday. This was a defense decimated by the Arizona State Sun Devils in the desert. The Huskies lose a heartbreaker 45-38. And Mark, it was painful to watch for a number of reasons. Number one, because this was a defense that literally could not stop anything or anybody. Emory Jones, the starting quarterback for the Arizona State Sun Devils, he goes out in the second quarter, and we're thinking, okay, we've got a walk-on, a former walk-on backup quarterback right coming in. The Dogs are going to eat this guy up. No. Xavier Holiday accounted for two more scores. Or no, that was the running back. Trent Borgay accounted for three touchdowns. I mean, just tore us up. And we were lit up all by this backup quarterback because our defense is completely demolished right now.
Yeah, and then when the quarterback starts, you know, making some throws, that does open things up for the running game. The Huskies have been pretty solid against the run this year, and then, you know, Arizona State was able to rip off some good runs at some key times, and it seemed like things just kind of snowballed for the second week in a row for the Husky defense. And I guess, Warren, I'm kind of curious.
All right, let's get a boogie on.
Sorry to our listeners.
That's
the great website, sportsreference.com, I have permanently opened during these podcasts. And now they have started inserting these new pop-up ads.
Yeah.
That, one, make it very, very much more difficult to access the statistics. And then, two, apparently they make noise when you're there on podcasts. So I'll have to find it.
Yeah, and unfortunately, the Huskies defense did not pop up at all on Saturday. and they were not making any noise whatsoever. And Mark, it was pretty amazing. It was embarrassing because this defense has been stripped so bare that there was a player, his name is His name is Sean Toomey Stout. He's a walk-on sophomore safety. He was in the game. Mark, he didn't even have his name on a jersey. He was just like, it was just like, hey, can you play defense? All right, get out there.
I mean, that's almost on the level of like pulling a kid out of the stands. Like,
it really,
when you don't have the name on the jersey, it's well, so did he earn a spot on the team in the walk-on tryouts that we were talking about just like in the last week or two?
I don't think so, because I can't imagine that he would be on the travel team, but I'm sure he was a backup special teams guy that really just was thrust in there, you know, unexpectedly. But I mean, Mark, to me, this is like the irony of ironies, right?
Yeah.
So think about this. What has Washington been known for the last 8 or 9 years? Like above everything else.
Defensive back play, future NFL defensive backs.
Future NFL defensive backs, Jimmy Lake, you know, the defensive back guru. And, you know, even last year when everything else was falling apart, we still had the top passing defense in the Pac-12. And we had two first and second round draft picks at cornerback, along with a couple other guys that made it on NFL rosters. So here's the irony, Mark, is that just less than a year removed, the greatest weakness of our team is this defensive backfield room. And in many ways, it's in part because of Jimmy Lake. So for years and years, we had all these four-star guys that came in. Since 2019, we've only recruited two four-star defensive backs, Jacoby Covington in 2019 and Tristan Dunn, who is a true freshman this year. Jacoby Covington unexpectedly entered the transfer portal after the spring game, transferred to USC, and that left, you know, a major hole for where he was a projected starter going into the season. So we've got Tristan Dunn out of there, all 6'4", 185 pounds of him, playing safety. We've got guys like Javion Green, who was a project of a recruit that we pulled in from Texas. Devon Banks, a guy that had no stars when we first offered him. Then guys like Javon Parker, defensive lineman, who again was a two-star recruit that we thought, okay, maybe this is a project 2, 3, 4 years down the road. He'll be, you know, a contributor. He's out there on the field on Saturday. And, you know, you heard the commentators throughout the game saying they don't seem to know what's going on the field. Like,
yeah,
it wasn't like, you know, Arizona State is taking advantage of these defenders. It was like they're throwing to wide open receivers because the defenders don't know what they're supposed to be doing out there. So, you know, it's an ironic thing that we were so loaded, and that kind of kept maybe the last couple of years us getting some experience. All four of those guys left to go to the NFL, and now the cupboard is, you know, seemingly, you know, empty, and the remaining cups have been, you know, cracked and put on the sideline.
So with all that said, Warren, what is kind of then the like short-term, long-term prognosis for fixing this? Are there guys that are injured that are going to make it back in the lineup relatively soon? Are you anticipating these guys that were just kind of thrown into action are going to play better after having a week of like real preparation as the starting unit? Like how are you kind of seeing that particular unit? Or is this potentially like something that could just torpedo the rest of the season? Like how are you assessing that?
Well, I think it could very well torpedo the season. It could torpedo the next 3 or 4 games and thus torpedo the whole season, because I think we're looking at Arizona now as like, this is a really dangerous team, because what is their strength? They've got two of the top wide receivers in the Pac-12 right now, coming in to Husky Stadium, and they've got to be licking their chops, because they're looking at that defense going, you know, as long as we give Jaden Delora 3 or 4 seconds to drop back, he's going to, you know, tear this defense apart, and then it's going to become a shootout. And so I think that's the challenge. So I think this is going to be, if it wasn't already, I think now that this defense has been publicly exposed, you can't chalk this up to a fifth-year starter and DTR. You can't chalk this up to Chip Kelly and what he's built over 5 years. There is a real problem here now. And I think this is where coaching is going to have to really come into the play. They're going to have to somehow scheme this defensive system in preparation for Arizona to somehow counteract the weakness of, you know, the roster that they have right now, because they can't just keep running an aggressive blitzing defense and leave those guys, those inexperienced and unproven guys, exposed to just be burned deep repeatedly. So that's, I think it's going to, you know, it'll be an interesting thing to see what this coaching staff can do as coaches, how they prepare the guys this week, and how they affect the game plan to overcome this obvious weakness.
So I think you assessed all that very clearly as kind of what the task is now. I have another question in terms of the other side of the ball, where it kind of, I think, makes sense that, you know, especially Washington was kind of out of sorts to start that game against UCLA. UCLA is a loaded offensive team. So the fact that Washington wasn't able to keep pace as much as they needed to in that game, I think we were kind of willing to give them like a mulligan of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
For Michael Penix and that crop of receivers who we've talked about as probably being the best receiving core in the Pac-12, for them not to be able to keep pace with this Arizona State defense and the former walk-on quarterback or Arizona State offense, how are you assessing that now as, you know, in terms of this upcoming stretch of these games that we kind of identified as winnable going into the year, Arizona, Cal, Oregon State? Is it fair to just look to Michael Penix and that receiving core and the offensive line and Kalen DeBoer and just say, we need 45 points a game. Like we need you to pick up the slack. We need you to basically score on nearly every drive. That's the way through this until we can get some of our guys back and kind of stop the bleeding. Is that a fair expectation to put on the offense? Cause I thought that offense looked capable of that through 4 weeks, and some flaws have shown up the last 2 weeks that I don't know if they're long-term flaws or if it was just they played a B-minus game and they're going to return to playing an A game the next week.
Yeah, I do think that is going to have to be the approach for this team from at least for the next few games until they can figure out if they can right the ship defensively. Michael Penix Jr. played a good but not great game again this week. Passed for over 300 yards again, sixth game in a row. Only other Husky quarterback to begin a season with 6 300-yard games was Cody Pickett. He did 7. And Michael Penix is already approaching like a very select list of, you know, quarterbacks with multiple 300-yard games in his Husky career. And he's only 6 games in. So, it, you know, the offense has certainly done a lot to impress. Unfortunately for Penix, he had one errant pass in the second quarter that careened off of an offensive lineman's back into the arms of an Arizona State defender who ran it in for a pick 6. That really put us in a hole midway through the second quarter. And ultimately, you could say that that was the difference in this game, was that, you know, that 7 or 14 point swing that pick six cost us. But Penix is certainly not the problem. He's going to have to be the solution, though, I think.
Right.
And the question, I think, will be, what kind of offense do they want to run? Because if they're running an explosive offense where the defense is back on the field rather quickly, mm-hmm. does that, you know, serve to, you know, hurt their chances? Or do they want to kind of go to an offense where they're working down the field, trying to put together 6 to 8 minute drives as opposed to explosive plays of 30 to 40 yards and getting those chunk plays down the field quickly? That'll be something that the offensive and defensive coaches are going to have to collaborate on. But I think you're right. I think for the next few games, until we can calibrate this defense, 45 points is probably the number to reach in order to feel good about your chances of winning.
Yeah, and that is asking a lot. I mean, it's one thing for your offense to score 45 when the defense is forcing turnovers and getting stops on third down and you're kind of feeling in a groove and it all kinds of builds. But there's a different kind of pressure that comes in on an offense when it's like, we have to score every time out just to keep pace. This is kind of like what Texas Tech has been like for as long mm-hmm. as we can remember, right? Where it's just yeah. like they've always got this high octane offense and a defense that is just a leaky faucet. And it's a whole different kind of pressure now to put on Penix and the rest of that offense. And I think they're up to it in the short term. I'm not sure they can do that for six games, yeah. you know? But like, if that's kind of the approach for the next couple games, mm-hmm. I think there's a way that they can kind of salvage this season. But it just feels like, gosh, whatever margin for error there was
mm-hmm.
is now just gone. And we saw that against Arizona State, where the offense was good, but not great. And right. because they were not great, they weren't able to get the victory. And that really puts them in a tough spot going forward.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think coming back home and playing Arizona, that should help them. Not because they're not going to have their challenges against that Arizona offense, but I do think being at home and Arizona's defense is not something that I think is going to present a unique challenge for the offense. But going back on the road, you know, the following week against California, 45 points is not going to be easy. So hopefully they've figured out some things by that point. And then, of course, we're looking at the final, you know, four games, which will include Oregon State, Washington State, and Oregon.
Right.
And then, you know, Colorado will be the kind of the one hopeful layup that we have there. But not a promising, you know, look at the next few weeks if this defense it continues to play like it did on Saturday.
Yeah. How quickly the fortunes turn, right? I mean, 2 weeks ago, I genuinely thought the Huskies were the best team in the Pac-12 coming out of September. And coming out of the UCLA game, I still felt like, yeah, they're still in the mix. And now it just really feels like.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, UCLA, to their credit, they beat Utah 42-32. They're a good team.
Yeah,
so I think, you know, like if we had beaten Arizona State and then we could look at the Utah result and go, okay, yeah, we're 5-1, but this UCLA team is really good.
Yeah.
But losing to a 1-4 Arizona State team basically makes it impossible to justify anything at this point. So that's out the window. But I think to your point, we were looking strong, especially coming out of Michigan State and then even still with the Stanford game. But the flaws really began to be revealed as we lost one additional defensive player after another. And, you know, Mark, I don't want to call out, you know, any individual players, but I think it's to me, it's a lesson just about the way that life works as well. We have a guy on our team, Cam Williams. He started as a true freshman. He's, I believe he's in his fourth or fifth year with the program. Was not starting it and not getting a lot of playing time at safety over the first four games of the season. And he decided to, basically forego the rest of the season before the Utah game, try to preserve a red shirt, and I would presume look to enter the transfer portal at the end of this year. And it's like, if he had not done that, he would be playing right now for sure. Right. He would be the number one starter
right.
on this defense because he's the most experienced guy on the team. But he made a decision. I mean, before he could even see what the outcomes were going to be, but also he made a decision that was best for him. Even now the team is, desperately in need of his leadership and experience. So those are the kind of things that this is the world that we're living in, guys that are projected starters entering the transfer portal after spring, games, guys four right. games into the season saying, I'm not going to play anymore. And, how does a coaching staff prepare for that? I don't know, but those are the kind of conversations that, we'd never had even just 5 to 10 years ago.
Yeah. And I've got to think there are some simple rule changes that could be implemented tomorrow that would just, solve some of that. Like I think the rule about if you want to sit out after your fourth game to preserve your eligibility, I think you should have to use that eligibility at the school that you're sitting out the rest of the season. So it's a joint decision you're making with your coaches. But I think it's like I think they should incentivize. I've even thought about this with the fifth year that we have due to COVID. Mm-hmm. Why not say you can have 5 years of eligibility at the school that you originally signed with out of high school? And if you transfer, you give up a year of eligibility. You get 4 years. Mm. And so, do something that gives players the freedom to seek out a new and better situation if that's what they need to do, but also incentivizes them to stick around for the long haul at the place that recruited them. There's got to be a way to kind of bring some more balance back to this because it's not fair to – the rest of the players and the coaching staff to have these guys that you're kind of relying on, coming into a season. And then at the last minute, they're pulling out and, packing up and looking for a different environment. Yeah.
You always hear players and coaches say next man up, but next man up doesn't work if the next man is out. And that's, that's what's happening. So the Huskies are playing Arizona this Saturday. The Ducks played Arizona this past Saturday. So give us a review of, what you saw from the Ducks and the Wildcats on Saturday. And, maybe there's some insight that you can provide for, what the future might hold for the Ducks moving forward.
Yeah. Well, coming into the game, you talked about the Huskies had not won in Tempe since 2001. Oregon's streak in Tucson wasn't quite that bad, but they had not won in Tucson since 2011.
Mm.
And that includes some pretty momentous upsets. Mark Helfrich brought a number two ranked Oregon against an unranked Arizona and lost with Marcus Mariota. Mario Cristobal brought a sixth ranked Oregon team with Justin Herbert against an unranked Arizona and lost in Tucson. So there have certainly been some really good teams that Oregon has sent down to Tucson and couldn't take care of business. This was not one of those teams. Dan Lanning wins his first game in Tucson and they win it in decisive fashion, 49-22. One of the stories of this game, Warren, is the Ducks offense just continuing to surge. They punted on their first possession and then they scored touchdowns on seven straight possessions before, calling off the Dogs basically in the middle of the third quarter, late third quarter. So this offense, since that week one, hiccup against Georgia, has just been firing on all cylinders. They're basically averaging almost 50 points a game since that loss. And I continue to think that's the story of this season that I didn't see coming at all. I did not see at the 6-game mark that Oregon would have the highest scoring offense in the Pac-12 and, you know, overall yardage per game, the best offense in the Pac-12, especially scoring 3 points in their season opener against Georgia.
Yeah, absolutely. And Bo Nix, you know, put up some really good, impressive stats again. The thing that stands out to me is just what he's doing, not through the air, but on the ground. Another 3 touchdowns on the ground, 70 yards rushing. What is it about, you know, the way that this offense is constructed or the way that Bo Nix is playing right now that's giving him these amazing rushing statistics?
He's a better athlete, I think, than I realized. That's certainly apparent. I think part of the advantage of those rushing stats is he still only has that one sack on the year for basically a half a yard loss. I think it was credited as a 1 yard loss. And, you know, the NFL does not count sacks against your rushing total. They're very deliberate about that. So if you look up Russell Wilson's rushing yards, you don't have to factor in how many times he was sacked. College football, for whatever reason, if a quarterback is tackled, it's counted as a rush. So you can have a really dynamic athletic quarterback that could basically run for the equivalent of 60 or 70 yards. And if he takes a 12-yard loss on a sack and takes a couple other sacks, his rushing total for the game looks pretty average. And so I think part of what's helped Bo Nix, you know, develop these really amazing statistics where he's averaging over 8 yards a carry is that he's just never being tackled behind the line of scrimmage. So every time that Bo Nix is tackled with the ball, it's because he's attacking the defense. He's scrambling out of the pocket and running for a first down, very occasionally running on a designed run. But most of his runs are the play is broken down and he's able to make something happen with his feet. They really don't seem to need to use him very, very much as, you know, as kind of a design play runner. They maybe run one or two of those types of plays a game, but when they do, they usually hit pretty big. So that's been a revelation as well. And I have to think, Warren, if you remember in the offseason when Travis Dye transferred to USC, I was so heartbroken because here's one of the greatest running backs in Oregon history, and he's choosing to play his last year at USC. And part of me was worried because it was like, who are we going to have to replace Travis Dye? Right. And now I'm looking that between Bucky Irving and Noah Whittington and Bo Nix, Oregon's got 3 of the top 10 rushers in the Pac-12, and they're all averaging a higher yards per carry than Travis Dye. And Oregon's rushing for more yards per game than any team in the conference. And so there's part of me that wonders, is Travis Dye looking over his shoulder and going, man, what kind of numbers could I have put up if I had stayed at Oregon? Because I'm shocked at how little they have felt his absence through the first half of the season.
Clearly, I mean, they're firing on all cylinders on offense. Tell me what you're seeing from this defense.
Yeah, the defense has been kind of the aspect of the team that I've been a little slower to embrace. I thought they had a really good first half against Stanford last week, and I thought they played overall pretty well against Arizona, especially containing those great receivers that we were concerned about. Their pass defense, you know, was probably better this game than it's been, considering the caliber of opponent. But they did give up a few backbreaking runs, and so that's an area that they're going to have to shore up. That's pretty unlike Oregon this season. They've been very good against the run for the most part. So, you know, that just seems like a lapse that you would expect them to correct in the film room. But the defense seems to be getting better. They're still not an elite defensive unit, but they do seem to be making progress each week. And especially the younger defensive backs that are working in are making some more plays. True freshman Jaleel Florence just got his first interception of the year off Jaden Delora. So you like to see that kind of, marked improvement from the young guys that are getting time in there.
So looking ahead to this Saturday, what's in store for the Ducks?
the Ducks get to put their hands behind their head and kick their feet up and watch, hopefully, a day full of pandemonium. I think there's three different matchups of top 10 teams. But the Ducks enjoy a bye this week, and it could not come at a better time, because next weekend, October 22nd, Oregon will host former Oregon coach Chip Kelly and those undefeated UCLA Bruins, who've already strung together back-to-back wins over Washington and over Utah. UCLA also has a bye this week, so we know that one of those teams is coming in undefeated. One of those teams will be coming in 5-1. They'll both be at least ranked in the top 12, potentially the top 10. I would imagine it would be a College Game Day choice for that game. It's, you know, Chip Kelly has not beaten Oregon yet since coming back to UCLA, but he's given them problems a few times, and this is by far the best team that Chip has had. It's going to be an electric atmosphere, and so it's good to have, you know, 2 weeks to kind of really gear up for that.
Well, we will go into depth about that game next week. But Mark, last week I said that, you know, if you cut me, I don't, you know, bleed blue or teal. I bleed purple. And, you know, I think that's still, you know, bears true, but you could say that I cry Northwest green. And certainly there were tears of joy on Saturday for the Seattle Mariners' epic comeback win over the Toronto Blue Jays. And then just a few short hours ago, from recording this podcast, the Huskies lost in epic fashion to the much-hated Houston Astros. So, Mark, walk us through a little bit of that first game that was taking place while the Huskies were being decimated in the desert. We were also cheering for our Mariners, who were stringing together some pretty magic moments.
Yeah, Saturday was, it was one of the craziest postseason games that there has been. Mariners trailed Toronto 8-1 in the sixth inning, and they trailed 9-6 by the eighth inning and put together two marvelous rallies. The first one was capped by Carlos Santana's three-run homer in the sixth, and then the second by JP Crawford's three-run double in the eighth, in which the ball fell between two different Blue Jay defensive players. But just a really, really frenetic, exciting game that is going to go down in history as one of the greatest Mariner moments and one of the greatest comebacks in playoff history.
Mark, it had to have been one of the most epic moments, and it felt all the more incredible because of this historic drought of playoff involvement for the Seattle Mariners. You know, you're thinking, okay, we won game one. We're getting crushed here in game two. What will the Mariners do, on Sunday in game three? And then all of a sudden, we don't need Sunday. Yeah. We're moving on. And that win coupled with today's loss seems to summarize a lot of the way that this Mariners team has performed really for the last year and a half, as just a team of, you know, epic highs and tremendous lows, a team that could come back at any moment and a team that can blow a lead at any moment. And, we saw that again today. So, you know, we're on the road, we're playing the Houston Astros. They've been the bully, and really they've picked on the Seattle Mariners, it seems like, more than anyone over the last few years. And here we are. We've struck first. We've landed the first blow.
Yeah.
We're up 4-0 against Justin Verlander. We knock him out of the game early, you know, at the end of the two innings. We're up 7-3. Momentum is on our side. And then it just, the last couple innings, it all falls apart.
Yeah.
And, you know, between Munoz and Robbie Ray and Seawald, like, what happened? I mean,
yeah.
And what do you make of putting in your starter Robbie Ray in game one of this playoff series? Like, what's the reasoning behind that? Like, we all remember those epic moments where guys, you know, starters come back in the World Series and they pitch a couple innings to help their team, you know, push through to the very end. Jack Morris and Oral Hershiser, you know, come to my mind. But why Robbie Ray? Why in game one?
Yeah.
When you've had a very strong bullpen for the whole year.
I don't like it. First of all, let me say, I love the idea in the postseason, the kind of the all hands on deck. Like, if it's your day off and you're a starting pitcher, you better be ready to come in and pitch to a batter if we need. Like, I love that aspect. And there are some great moments, whether it's Randy Johnson coming out of the pen for the Mariners or the Diamondbacks or Clayton Kershaw or Madison Bumgarner. There's all these great moments of like, you know, these legendary starters making the walk in to pitch the ninth inning or something like that. And it gives you kind of chills because it's like the rule book is thrown out. They're doing anything they can to win this series. And I love that about playoff baseball. With that said, I am a firm believer that if you are going to bring in a starter out of the bullpen, you give him adequate time to warm up, and then you bring him in the beginning of an inning so that he's pitching in the same way that he's been accustomed to pitching all season long.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is you don't bring him in to face the best hitter on the opposing team with two runners already on base, a jam that he didn't create.
Right.
And now you're bringing him in and expecting him to work himself out of the jam on the very first batter that he's faced, because starting pitchers don't operate that way. Relief pitchers do.
Yeah.
Relief pitchers have signed up for that. They understand it's part of the deal. Most of them are just coming in and throwing 100 miles an hour anyway these days. So it's like they kind of get it that that's part of the job description. But like asking a guy like Robbie Ray, who has finished one game in his major league career, and that was his rookie year in 2014, 8 years ago, asking him to come in and pitch to one batter to close out this game is kind of like you're asking one of your best hitters to come in and pinch hit, but only after there's an 0-2 count against them. And then you're saying, all right, go in off the bench and put a good swing on the ball. And it's like, well, I'm used to kind of doing it a different way.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, no, you know, we need you to get one out. And I did not have a good feeling. I was listening to this game on the radio, actually driving around. I was not watching at that moment, but I was listening. And as soon as I heard that they were warming up Robbie Ray to face Alvarez, I thought, I don't like this. I don't like this. And if a home run is the only thing that can beat you in that moment, why don't you just walk Alvarez, load the bases, take your chances with Bregman, who already, granted, had hit a home run in the previous inning, so maybe that's not much of a better choice. But I don't know. It just felt like kind of some overmanaging on the part of Scott Service, who's been a fantastic manager for the Mariners and has pulled the right strings time and time again in games like this. So I don't want to be too harsh on him, but I just have a philosophical belief that you don't do that with a starting pitcher.
And I think, you know, I agree with everything you said. Then to top it off, the fact that Robbie Ray has not been dominating the last several starts. So it's not like you're bringing in a guy who's been hot, who has been, you know, on fire. Like if let's say, you know, Luis Castillo had, you know, pitched a day earlier and he wasn't scheduled to pitch the next game. If they had brought in Castillo, you know, because of the kind of pitcher, the heat that he brings and the four different pitches that he can produce
Right.
You know, like that to me makes sense. Like, you know, there are starting pitchers who have the kind of stuff that they can come in and they can pitch against one guy and take care of business. But I don't think Robbie Ray is that kind of a pitcher. No. And that's not a criticism against Robbie Ray. Like he's won a Cy Young award. I'm not criticizing what he does, but the style of pitcher that he is doesn't really translate well to a one inning or even just a one batter scenario.
Yeah. And you pointed it out. He was rocky in his last five starts or so in the regular season. He did not have a good postseason start against Toronto. So it just is, it's pretty baffling. And it's hard to defend. Of course, had he gotten Alvarez to pop up, we'd be talking about it as like this brilliant managerial move that, oh, they bring in Robbie Ray for the last out. Now he's got his confidence back. But man, what a backfire to get to Justin Verlander right off the bat, the way the Mariners did. I think they scored with one out in the first inning. So that means, you know, if there were 53 outs in this game, the Mariners led during 52 of them. Like, like they held the lead. They had a multiple run lead for the entire game, and to be up 7-3 going into the eighth inning and to not come out of that with a win is just as crushing as that win over Toronto was thrilling.
It is. And, you know, if you were watching the game or listening to the game, there was a moment, I can't remember what inning it was. Maybe it was the third or fourth inning, but Yordan Alvarez threw out Ty France as he was, you know, running home. You know, he was coming from second. Ty France is not known for his speed, and it wasn't even close. Like, you know, they nailed him, and the catcher was just waiting for him, you know, and France just kind of gave up. And the announcer said, you know, at that point, the Mariners had a big lead. I think they were up 7-3 at that moment. You know, they were saying, hey, this is probably not going to amount to much, but it could amount to something.
Yeah.
And I think that it proved to be true. You know, why they waved France in to from you know, rounding third, that was a bad decision that really, you know, cost them potentially one or more runs, because they were stringing together a good number of hits in that inning.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Kelenic got tossed out for an unnecessary steal, I think, an inning later.
Right.
But, you know, you just, those little mistakes in the playoffs can become major, you know, major factors in the game later. So hopefully this is just a bump in the road, but, you know, we're looking now ahead. I think the next game is on Thursday. Am I correct on that?
Yeah, which is really good, I think, for the Mariners to get a day off after the devastation of this. If they had to turn around and play tomorrow afternoon, it would.
Right. They've got Luis Castillo, you know, so they've got the race. They've got an opportunity to kind of get right after a devastating loss. But, you know, how many games can you give away against a team like the Astros, who won over 100 games this year?
Yeah, it's a tough one to swallow. It really is. I mean, you don't want to start to speculate that that's going to be the difference in the series, because there's still games ahead for the Mariners to try to get back into it. And if they win one in Houston, and they take it home, that place is going to be crazy on Saturday. There's going to be a really good energy there. The Mariners have been waiting a while to come back home and play a postseason game at home. So you'd rather not have that Saturday game be just kind of staving off elimination. But if they can equalize it on Thursday, make the trip home, and then come in Saturday with a chance to really, you know, take control back of the series, you know, we'll see what happens. But man, was this a tough one, Warren?
It was a tough one. So just hypothetically, Mark, if the Mariners end up losing this you know, series 3-2, do you walk away feeling like, wow, you know, we did it. We finally made it to the playoffs. We won the first round. or are you just devastated because of the game that got away?
So I think it kind of depends on how the rest of the game, like if the Astros win two more games at some point in this series, and you said if it goes five, say it goes five, but the Astros win like 11-2 in game five, I'm not going to be thinking that much about how game one got away. I think it's if the Mariners lose one or two more like this, and it really kind of feels like, gosh, you know, but I think overall this season they're playing with house money. Like they broke this 21-year streak. They played in a playoff series in which they had to win multiple games on the road, and they did it, and they did it with one of the most memorable games in all of postseason history.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that J.P. Crawford bloop hit, which cleared the bases, is, you know, that's one of the handful of greatest Mariners moments ever. It's you know, below Edgar's double, but it's not really below anything else. Mm-hmm. So I think at this point it's house money. You know, they're playing the best team in the league, a team that's owned them in the regular season, and it's a real bummer that they let him off the hook.
Yeah,
game one. And it's either going to be a bummer that they let him off the hook in game one because they had a chance to beat a better team, or it's going to be, hey, they faced some real adversity and they bounced back from that and, you know, played a good rest of the series. So we'll see how they respond.
Well, we will see, and we'll be back next week for another edition of the Dog and Duck Show. We'll be keeping tabs on the college football Seattle Mariners. So please continue to listen to the Dog and Duck Show. You know, rate, subscribe, like, share, tell your mom and your uncle and your neighbors and your friends. And we'll go ahead and wrap things up. For all of our dog fans out there, go Dogs.
For all our duck fans, go Ducks.
We'll catch you guys next time.